The United States is caught up in a partisan war, pulling apart politicians, communities, even families.
In a time of heightened political tension, our next guest has an idea of what's driving this polarized atmosphere around the world.
The political division in the country undeniably deep right now.
The big question on a lot of people's minds, can Americans come together and heal?
Loud, angry, deeply divided. The public dialogue around difficult issues has never felt more polarized. Is there a way forward? This is Global Affairs Today. Let's start the conversation. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Imani Cherry. When it comes to our public discourse these days, it seems like our rhetoric is getting harsher and our political positions are getting further apart. And it's not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world, partisan hostility is showing up in both politics and everyday life. Have we lost the art of civil discourse? To start our conversation today, we're joined by Manu Mil, CEO of Bridge USA. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Imani.
So could you tell us a little bit about what you do at Bridge USA?
Absolutely. Just like you have green spaces in a city, we're building civic spaces on college campuses. Our fundamental belief is that people are the basis of our democracy, and our goal is to make people more empathetic, more constructive, and more solution-oriented, so that not only can we have a more trustful society, but we can have a better politics that works for every American.
So what was that tipping point that caused you to found this organization, this movement?
It's such a good question. So in 2017, I was a freshman at UC Berkeley. I just graduated this last year in May. And back when I was a freshman, there were these huge protests. The speaker by the name of Milo Yiannopoulos had come to college campus. He was a right-wing provocateur. And the response to his speech was just absolutely crazy for me. There was huge amounts of violence on campus. There was protests. People were getting attacked because a lot of people didn't like his speech. Now, I'm also not a Milo fan, but I come from a democracy that isn't as robust as the United States. And I know what happens when we resort to violence and when we resort to a lack of productive engagement in our politics. And so after that incident where UC Berkeley was cascaded in the national spotlight, my thought was that there are so many young people that disagree with not only what happened, but young people that want a better politics where we can not only converse with each other, but we can understand and see each other's humanity in our arguments. We're not judging each other by just their intentions. And that's our goal. It's to understand and create spaces so that young people can better understand each other, so that we have a foundation for a better democracy.
Wow. So in a 2017 article, you wrote in the Huffington Post that, quote, culture of compromise can only develop at the grassroots level. It begins with American people. What did you mean by that?
That people are the fundamental unit of democracy. We are what drive what happens in this country. People are what vote at the ballot box. People are who cast election votes. People are who make their voices heard on television. No matter where society goes, it is the fact that people drive what happens in this country. And we need to recognize that we have a lot more agency than we give ourselves credit for. And when I'm talking about a culture of compromise, what I specifically mean by that, Imani, is not necessarily that we need to give up our beliefs, but it's that if people drive this need for a better engaged politics, where not only are we seeing the fact that young people are engaged in many visceral ways, but the fact that there is so much hope in the fact that a lot of things unite us. Our goal is to empower those people. Our goal is to make those people not only the voices, but to elevate their platforms, demonstrate that the disunity that we see not only in our media and in our politics, but the disunity we see in our everyday lives is not only untenable, but it is not what anyone wants. And our objective is to demonstrate that. We have to start one conversation at a time. If we don't start one conversation at a time, our democracy is not at the correct starting point. So our objective is let's empower those folks, let's get them engaged, and importantly, let's get them active. Students have driven so many social movements in history, and there's no reason why they can't drive this one.
Why do you think empathy is so important in politics? And that's a very psychological term. Why empathy?
Empathy is a very psychological term. It's also a term that is easy to understand in many cases, but it's very hard to practice. Someone that we respect dearly once said that the best antidote to polarization is humanization. How do you humanize folks? How do you see that you are a person first who has life experiences, who has a family, who has a background that has informed how you grow up? Empathy is about seeing those things. Let's say, Imani, you say that I want more gun control. I immediately respond and I say, gun control is terrible. It's bad for our country and it'll tear apart our social fabric. Instead, let me take a step back and understand why you said that. What was the reason? What was your value? Was it perhaps that you might have gone to a school that might have witnessed a mass shooting? Was it that you might have a family member that was engaged in violence because of guns? Was it because you're perhaps on the streets of Chicago where there's such high gun homicide rates? That's what empathy is. It's recognizing that we all have valid, real experiences that inform our positions, and that those experiences are not only as valid as my experiences, but they matter just as much in the conversation. And understanding and helping us recognize those experiences will get us a lot farther in our politics.
Manu, thank you so much for sharing with us that it's so important that we have empathy, especially in today's world, in our conversations as well. So thank you for joining us. And thank you for the work that you do at Bridge USA.
Thank you so much for having me. We need to elevate young people. We need to show people that are doing a good work in society. So thank you.
Absolutely. We're taking a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to keep exploring this question of how to heal our civil discourse. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking today about ways to bridge deep divisions in our society. I'm glad to welcome two guests to help us explore this topic. Michael Ware is the founder of Public Square Strategies and was the director of faith outreach for President Obama's 2012 reelection campaign. And Tina Ramirez is the founder and president of a human rights organization called Hardwired, and she was a political candidate in the 2020 election cycle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
I want to find out more about the different perspectives each of you bring to the issue we're talking about today. So, Tina, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a bit about Hardwired and what you guys do there?
Sure. Hardwired is an organization I started about 8 years ago after having worked in Congress and seen conflict front and center in a lot of the countries where I was working. There was a lot of religious persecution, but often the people on the ground didn't have their tools to respond to it themselves. They would look to the U.S. or foreign countries to come in and help them. And so what Hardwired does is we go on the ground into countries where there's severe religion-related conflict, and we provide local training, whether it's within the education system, within the legal system, or within civil society, to train up leaders that can defend the human right to freedom of religion or belief for all people. And so we help change laws, change policies, change cultures and societies to be more respectful and to be able to live in peace with one another.
Well, so Michael, what about you? What experiences have shaped your perspective on this issue of bridging deep divisions and political divide and polarization?
Oh, goodness, many from my family growing up in Buffalo, New York, which is an interesting place politically, to my time in the White House working for President Obama. Currently, I run Public Square Strategies, which is a firm that tries to help the faith community work with help the faith community when they step out in public, Christian organizations when they are exerting public leadership of some kind, and then helping mainstream institutions work with the faith community to advance shared goals. Sort of through all of these experiences, I've come to believe and know that politics is an essential forum in which we can love our neighbor. Unfortunately, not many people think of politics that way right now, and just that fact alone helps explain a lot of what we see on the news and on our Facebook pages.
Right. So, Michael, you mentioned that people don't automatically think of love and empathy when they start talking about politics and how we engage publicly. So, Tina, you know, it feels like you know, the political tone in this country has been very divisive, and probably the most divisive and polarized it's ever been. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think so. I remember, you know, when I first started thinking about politics, it was in the 90s when the Clinton scandals were happening. So it certainly was pretty divisive then, but I feel like it's gotten a lot worse since. When I ran for Congress, I did it for that reason. I felt like I can go all over the world and work with communities, like, for instance, in Iraq, that have just committed genocide against each other. And somehow I can bring them together and help them come together and have a common vision for rebuilding their country, and recognizing that if one of them is attacked, then they're all, then really their freedom is at risk for all of them. And so it's amazing to see what we can overcome in other countries and what we have in the last 8 years with my organization. But when I look at what's happening in our country, it's definitely very concerning to see that the idea that people have differences of belief, that they have freedom of conscience, that those basic rights aren't even respected in our society anymore, that we can't have diversity of thoughts, of opinions, and somehow have a civil conversation around that. That used to be the fabric of America and what we were built upon, this idea of pluralism. And I do definitely think that it's at risk right now. And so that was one of the things that motivated me to run. And it was a really great experience.
Michael, did what Tina just say about that, does that fit with your experience on the ground?
Well, so social scientists refer to something called affective polarization, which basically refers to the idea that polarization isn't always a bad thing. Our politics ought to be about substantive disagreement and working that out through the political process. What we see a lot of now is disagreement fueled by animosity and our politics taking shape, not positively, not in support of something, but in opposition to something. And when you're in that place, as Tina sort of suggested, it's very hard to do the work of governance together. And as citizens, it's important to know, I think people talk about politicians and state capitals and say, oh, those bums, look how polarized they are. Look, the state of our politics is a reflection of the state of our souls. It's a reflection of us. And as a citizen, you do not choose to have political influence. You already have it. Your choice is about what to do with it. And so we're all implicated in this. We all have a responsibility to improve the situation. I think, I'm not sure, debates about whether we're the most polarized ever are we're polarized now in ways that are clearly not helpful to building a cohesive society. And that's something that we all need to address.
So when it comes to bridging differences, you know, a lot of people rely on their faith to guide them. Tina, how does faith play a role in bridging that gap where there's just so much animosity?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really important to recognize that every human being is, we like to say, hardwired. That's the name of my organization, but hardwired to believe in something. And, you know, it might be a religious belief, or it just might be something different, but everyone is really wired with a conscience and a spirit. That's how we are as human beings. And so recognizing that at the very base level is critical to then recognizing the value of human dignity and the diversity within humanity, and that the need for a public marketplace of ideas that are different and vibrant. Because as human beings, we are truth seekers. We're constantly looking for truth, for justice, for right and wrong. That's just who we are. And so I think that when people understand that, and understand that every human being has a right to explore that, that that's inherent in who they are as a human being, and they have a inherent dignity and ability to do that, that that's the base level. When you can do that, and like I said, we bring people together from very different viewpoints in many countries where they were literally killing each other. And when they can get to a point where they can take off their rose-colored glasses and see the humanity of the other and the inherent rights of the other person as a human being that has this need to explore and seek truth and understand what justice is, then we have an opportunity for a civil dialogue. And that's really where it begins.
Well, that sounds, you know, ideally, that sounds nice that we can come to the table and all get along. But it feels like ironically, that faith is actually driving our political divisiveness. I mean, it sounds so antithetical, don't you think, Michael?
As a Christian, I find great resources in the faith to find my security, not in politics, but in the gospel of Jesus Christ. I find in my faith great resources to love my enemies and not to seek to undermine my quote-unquote political enemies at every turn and be motivated by a desire to undermine them. I find great resources in my faith to support those who are and seek to help those who are in need. And so we need to start thinking about the ways in which our faith not is only or just a support to us and a resource for our private and inner lives, our marriages, our finances, but actually understand that the teachings of Jesus Christ have application for how we act in public. And if Christians alone did this, if just a percentage of Christians did this, we would have a much healthier politics.
We're going to take a quick break right now, but don't go away. The conversation continues in just a moment. Welcome back to our discussion today, where we're asking, have we lost the art of civil discourse? So, Tina, I want to start off with you. You've worked in many places around the world, in the Middle East, in Africa, where you've worked in very hostile communities who have deep divisions, historical divisions even. So what have you learned from those experiences? And could you give us a few examples of how you were able to bridge those divides?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I've worked in Iraq, in northern Nigeria, where Boko Haram is prevalent, in Sudan, South Sudan. So some of the hotspots around the world, and I've traveled to all of them. So I can tell you that it's not, you know, it's not a luxurious job. It's you know, it's on the ground. It's really working with people that are facing some serious challenges, some life and death challenges. But in those environments, what I find is that they really face the same issues that we face here in America. Across the world, you see the exact same thing. Everyone has a certain set of fear, misperceptions of others, and bias. And there's usually just a kind of a string of them that we could see, whether you're in the United States or you're in Iraq. It's the same fears that drive people to be intolerant, to misunderstand, to miscommunicate, to discriminate. And so it's just how you navigate and address those challenges. And so that's what we do in these countries. We are not, I think one of the things that we do that's so unique is that a lot of groups go in and they look at the type of work that we do as an interfaith dialogue, which is great. That's obviously an important aspect of our work. But we actually usually do not meet on the areas of commonality. We meet on the areas of difference because no one ever entered a conflict over something that they had in common. It's usually something that they don't have in common, that they have a serious disagreement about. And if you really want to address that, you need to hit it head on. And so that's what we do in these challenging environments. And by hitting it head on and teaching people how to work together based on their respect for the humanity and the freedom of conscience of one another, we're able to have some significant, make some significant progress in these areas.
So, Michael, you know, the White House is not exactly the Middle East, but, you know, what was your experience at the White House trying to bridge differences and, you know, talk to people across the political aisle?
Yeah, so it was beneficial for me. I was in the Office of Faith-Based Neighborhood Partnerships and helping the president navigate a range of sort of religious issues and relationships. That work was primarily oriented towards serving those in need. And so we were able to bring together a pretty wide range of actors to focus on an issue like combating human trafficking or supporting and strengthening adoption in this country. And when you focus on an area of need, particularly one where the stakes are clear. So sometimes we go to politics for triviality, and then we wonder why we treat other people in politics so poorly. And we just need to stop going to politics for triviality. When we go to politics, it should be to advance human dignity. It should be to advance justice and affirm human dignity. And if we go to politics for that, we'll find that we could find common ground on a whole range of things, because we're just trying to improve lives. We're just trying to make things better. And so that's a key thing that I've learned. We can't, we have allowed for politics to become entertainment in a way that is deeply harmful. And so we go to politics looking for self-affirmation and validation. We go to politics looking to be offended. Well, let me tell you, in a country as big as ours, if you go to politics looking to be offended, you'll find reason for offense. But my suggestion would just be, don't go to politics for that. When you're going to act in politics, it should be on the behalf of others in a way that Tim Keller talks about in a different context, a way that is self-forgetful. We need more self-forgetfulness in our politics, so we'd be a lot better off.
So let's just bring this down to a ground level, a grassroots level, if you will. You know, Tina, you mentioned that people kind of want the same thing, really. They just don't know how to talk about it. And, you know, Michael, you said that, you know, politics should be about improving lives. So how do we as individuals, you know, go about talking to one another about these issues when it feels like the people at the top don't even want to agree ever, really? How do we do that as individuals? Tina?
Well, I think that first, I like what Michael just had to say. I think he's spot on and he articulated it very well. We have to recognize the humanity of others. We have to recognize that we are going to have differences of opinion and that that's okay. I think, unfortunately, too many people come into conversations over differences and they want to force the other person to have the same kind of belief as them, or force them to agree with them. And we have to realize that there's a right to be wrong, that not everyone's going to agree, and that's okay. That's what makes for a vibrant civil society. And challenging conversations and having those differences refines all of us. And so I think we need to stop being afraid of difficult conversations, of people saying things that, like Michael said, might offend us or that we don't like or don't agree with. We need to kind of take it down a notch and recognize, who is that person as a human being? What do they mean? How do they feel? That empathy that you, the person that was in the video at the very beginning talked about, that's really critical. And then from that, we can build a conversation. Often we don't listen in conversation. And so the most important thing is to listen and to understand what the other person's really trying to feel. And Michael and I remember when he came up to the Hill and when I was working in Congress at the time and brought some ideas about legislation forward, where he was trying to bring both sides together. And it was really a thoughtful conversation. And that's the kind of work that I think we need to do, where we can try to see the other person's needs and frustrations and concerns and find common ground.
And Michael, same question. What about you? How do we talk at an individual level?
If politicians are getting credit for doing substantive work on an issue, if they get a whole bunch of response from, I really appreciated the thoughtful plan that you laid out on this issue that's important to my life. I really liked the way that you engaged with that person from the other side of the aisle. You know, I don't agree with them, but it's good to see politicians, elected officials who don't agree working together to serve people. They'll do more of those kinds of things. Instead, when I'm talking with elected officials, they say, look, I spent months preparing to issue, my suggestions for how we move forward on this policy area. And my staff spent, hundreds of hours on it, got very little response. No media wanted to talk to me. My constituents weren't as interested as I thought they would be. But man, when I went after what some fringe member of Congress on the other side of the aisle said in an interview on a fringe media outlet, my phones lit up and the donations came in and everybody wanted to talk to me. And I was able to use that attention to to get something quietly from my constituents that all the public hard work I did, you know, didn't get any of that attention. And so that's all to say, if you see politicians doing good things, for instance, I'll give you an example. President Biden was doing a town hall last week, and a small business owner raised questions about raising the minimum wage. And typically we have a political environment now where if anybody raises a question about a policy you support, you question their motives. You say that they must not really care about the things you care about. And instead, in that town hall, in that CNN town hall, President Biden said, you know, I just want to acknowledge that it's a rational, legitimate concern for a small business owner to wonder about the effect that raising the minimum wage will have on their small business. He went on to explain that he thought that balanced out and that it was a net good. But I just thought that was so refreshing. And obviously, there are examples from Republican politicians. I'm not trying to focus on a Democrat. But President Biden got hit for that by the left, by parts of the left who don't want to acknowledge the legitimacy of anything that that goes against their policy priorities. President Biden needs to hear from people who say, look, I'm so glad that you engaged that woman in earnest conversation and didn't demonize her and treated her as a rational person. Then President Biden might do it again the next town hall. He might say, hey, the American people are hungry for this kind of engagement. And I think we are. We just need to show it. We need to let politicians know not just what we don't like about what they do, but when they do something that we do like, we need to credit them for it. Because that's how we build an incentive structure that will help facilitate a healthier politics.
Well, you're not a politician, Michael, but I want to thank you for joining us today and for what you're contributing. And Tina, you as well. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great conversation, honestly.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And for you at home, thanks for joining us. As always, remember to go to hopetv.org and talk to us on Twitter @GlobalToday7. Until next time, stay well and keep the conversation going.